Building Bridges with Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. The Fire, next time, our continuing examination of white supremacy in 21st century America in the wake of the executions of 9 African-American women and men at a historically radical institution for African resistance and freedom. I don't know if Ed Whitfield, he probably does recognize John Coltrane's Alabama, which is a composition that appears on his album Live at Birdland. It was written in response to the 16th Street Baptist Church bombing on September 15th, 1963, an attack by the Ku Klux Klan in Birmingham, Alabama, that killed 4 little girls. It seemed to me to be the perfect segue into our ongoing concern of the prevalence of white supremacy, of racism within this society. You know, as Professor Charles Lawrence precisely puts it, racism in America is much more complex than either the conscious conspiracy of a power elite or the simple delusion of some ignorant bigots. It is a part of our common historical experience and therefore a part of our culture. It arises from the assumptions we have learned to make about the world, ourselves, and others, as well as from the patterns of our fundamental social activities. In our discussion coming up with Ed Whitfield, long-term social justice organizer, co-managing director of the Fund for Democratic Communities, who speaks and writes on issues of cooperatives and economic development, on issues of education and social responses to racism, and is active in the call by the Southern Grassroots Economies Project to develop a Southern Reparations Loan Fund. We're going to plow deep into the bowels of America to ferret out and grapple with its policies and practices of white supremacy, rooted deep within its public and private structures and their functions. We'll look at how then institutional racism filters down to the individual citizenry and becomes as well a material force to subjugate black life. Contemporary attitudes and practices, behaviors that are racist, do not exist in a vacuum. And until America as a country and its every white inhabitant owns its complicity, acquiescence to, or benefit from racism, those manifestations will not be dealt with, and the manifestations which are woven into the fabric of every aspect of life will not be addressed, and we will not be saved, and democracy will certainly remain elusive. Will we wait for the fire next time? Or will we, in every endeavor, tear out at the roots of the poisonous weeds of white supremacy that ultimately subsumes all healthy growth and life's nurturance. And with that, it's, yes, some of my feeling and concern and sensitivity in response to this latest debacle to the execution of 9 sisters and brothers in Charleston, South Carolina. And Ed Whitfield, thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you for inviting me. That was quite an introduction.
Well, you're quite a person to have on. That's one thing, your history of activism. And this really must be a teachable moment. So maybe we should begin with that very question of, this doesn't happen in a vacuum. And the tendency to ferret out the most extreme groups as the culprit, the white supremacist organization, isn't that too easy as the point of condemnation for the general society when it comes to racism?
Absolutely. I mean, what we have is a very, very deep, as you pointed out, system problem. And at the point that we can point our finger to an extreme individual as the principal manifestation of that problem, then it kind of lets the system problem off the hook temporarily in our mind. And it's an absolutely serious event, tragic on the one hand, evil on the other, that took place in Charleston, South Carolina. But it in no sense represents the scope of the remaining racism in this country. I shouldn't even use the word remaining racism, because that implies that that it's almost all gone away. And there's some things that have shifted in form, and certainly any number of improvements that have come on the basis of the powerful struggles of the people, both in this country and the people around the world, quite frankly, that some of the transformation of civil rights in this country can be attributed to. A lot of people don't think about the role that the Cold War played in the federal government's changing position on civil rights. But I think that the African-American people in this country and all those who seek freedom and justice have reason to be very thankful for the righteous struggles of people around the world that led the United States to realize that it couldn't continue to treat African-American citizens the way it was treating them and try to win the hearts and minds of the people of Asia, Africa, and Latin America. But anyhow, that's adding too many things into one sentence. We have a very deep system problem. We have individual manifestations of this problem and things like this murderer in South Carolina. As you again pointed out, he didn't do this in a vacuum. He did this in a society that is steeped with an attitude that has black lives not having any value, that has, you know, the mythology of how wonderful and persevering America is, and a mythology of undeserved begging for access that's going on the part of other folks. And, you know, he was reflecting this. You know, some of the statements I understand that he made were a reflection, but you could have heard the same types of statements just by listening to mainstream newscasts. These are things that are very prevalently in the air. Any number of politicians carry these same attitudes, and they've gotten to be very popular in recent years. But this reflection is, again, of this deeper thing that goes on where black labor have been stolen and put to the advantage of an economic system that was seeking to concentrate ownership and privilege and wealth in a handful of a tiny minority of folks who are continuing to concentrate that. And that system is very much in place and not at all simply the result of madmen, angry, evil, mad folks like this guy in South Carolina.
You know, I remember going, not much of a memory because it really just happened, when last week the murders, the executions came to the fore in really kind of desperation and misery. I just returned to some of the readings of Ralph Ellison and James Baldwin to really continue to eke out a sensitivity, and really how pointed white supremacy is within this country and what its manifestations are to the individual of African ancestry and within the society. The racial topography of America is, James Baldwin said, is certainly not a dreamscape of possibility, but it's a sobering and ongoing nightmare. And I find that still to be the case, although mass media would certainly try to continue to focus on the progress. Is that how you view things, the progress that we should not look askance at, but, or is it really going back to James Baldwin, the continuing sobering and ongoing nightmare?
It's absolutely a nightmare, and I think that the principal form that it takes is the fact that people are incapable of fully realizing their humanity. People are incapable of fully realizing their humanity because the overwhelming majority of people in many communities are separated from the opportunities to be the full productive people that they could be by virtue of the whole nature of the concentrations of wealth and power that have taken place. And we got to understand that this concentration of wealth and power is rooted deeply in stolen lives, stolen labor, stolen capital. When it happens, we have communities that are basically empty of the wealth that they themselves have created. And those people who have access to the wealth that they created go on to live much broader and more interesting lives outside of that. And folk are left to eke out, you know, pretty bare existence within those communities where, again, the wealth that they have created has been extracted. And that continues. Not only does it continue, it's getting worse. It's not getting any better. The scale of the wealth extraction, the scale of the disparity, the gap between the wealthy and the poor is growing wider. And so while there has been some nominal progress around questions of, you know, there used to be these biological theories of race that were kind of biological determinism, biological essentialism, that people were considered to be biologically inferior, have smaller, black folks were considered to have smaller brains, less of a capacity to delay gratification, all on the basis of their biology. And that could be unpopular, and folks realized that that didn't make a lot of sense. So then they shifted it to a kind of cultural determinism and essentialism and said, well, it's not their biology. You know, maybe they could potentially be different. But they grew up in these communities where those are the prevailing ideas, and so they have this culture of poverty, and it leads them to have incapacity to delay gratification. It makes them have smaller brains. So it was a minor shift. But in a way, that's progressive, that you even got away from the biological notion. What people haven't gotten away from at all is the idea that there's something fundamentally undeserving of people who live in the African-American communities in this country, and that as such, they are part of an undeserving poor, that you want to avoid at any cost, potentially advantaging, because, you know, those undeserving poor people make bad choices. As though wealthy people don't make bad choices. My contention is everybody makes bad choices at some point, but the buffer of wealth makes, I like to think about the cascading consequences of bad choices when you don't have any money, when you can't buy your way out of it. Either through paying a good doctor or paying a good lawyer or paying somebody to get out of it. But the bad choices are around us all the time. That's not the issue. The question is, what communities have access to their own creative wealth as a basis for continuing to build and allowing them to be productive and creative? And that's something that is largely missing. That's why I do work right now around a lot of economic issues. And we have to work really hard on this. An economic transformation that has to take place if I think we can ever fundamentally do away with these questions of racism in this country.
You know, you're reminding me, and really Martin Luther King said it early on, the kind of three pillars to relate to and work and one was the direct and most essential of confronting racial animus and bigotry and bias and discrimination. The second pillar was dealing with the issue of militarism, and the third really being the incredible economic deprivation and increasing poverty. These were the three pillars, really, of capitalism that were impacting and decimating the communities of African descent within our country. Is that really still the pivotal thing that you're suggesting that really has to be addressed, and that the fundamental issue, albeit not an unimportant one, the symbolism of taking down the Confederate flag? My goodness, Walmart said it's not going to sell the Confederate flag anymore. Good gracious, Walmart. Is that those three pillars really where we need to go to address and really uproot fundamental racist ideology and practice in this country?
Oh, absolutely. Those same three things are still very much in place. We can hear it in the rhetoric around the death of these young men and women at the hands of police violence and state-sanctioned violence. We can hear it in the ongoing so-called war on terror, which is a brutal, really vicious kind of war done largely by remote control and sanitized conditions, where it's only sanitized on this end. On the other end, it's murderous, bloody, and terrible, and we just don't have to look at it very often. And again, the ongoing grinding poverty in communities has been stripped of people's chances to be, you know, a productive workforce, and use the wealth that they're generating to continue to build and develop the communities. Those exact three things are still in place. The kind of resources that get siphoned off of the social productivity of our community that go into the military apparatus, and the huge profits that go into these military profiteers that benefit from any and every kind of war. It's a ridiculous amount of our resources. It's weird. It's almost inconceivably large. I mean, these drones and stuff cost millions and millions and millions of dollars. And it's something about sanitized remote control warfare, where you don't have to see the faces of the people that you're blowing apart, the children's bodies strewn across the ground, the wedding parties that were attacked, the panic in the eyes of folk every time they hear something that sounds like a predator drone flying over, circling overhead before one of these hellfire rockets comes down that you can't even hear because it's going faster than sound. This is a sick way for a highly developed, militarized country to be behaving in the world. I think it will obviously have its repercussions. It's continuing to right now. We should be very concerned with that. We need to, as a people, figure out how we're going to stop. And a lot of these justifications that are being made, and whatever the latest lie that is told to us by the military and the intelligence organizations, and being spread by this president, you know, is evidently trying to prove how tough he can be. It's really, really sad. But at the same time, the young people who are in the streets saying that Black Lives Matter, saying that we should say her name about the many black women who have been also the victims of state-sanctioned violence, they are a true blessing that we have that, you know, really gives a lot of hope that there will be social justice movements and people continue to fight until we have transformed some things. We have to shift those fights into directions that allow people to meaningfully transform their community. And I'm not just talking about, well, young need to quit having protest marches and don't vote. I think that building social justice movements is even more powerful than voting. Best I can tell, the changes in the vote, the changes in the franchise, didn't come about by people voting to change them. The changes in the franchise came about by social justice movements that existed outside of the voting arena, putting pressure on government structures to change the process by which voting takes place. And so these young folks are doing some of the most important things that need to be done right now, building these broad social justice movements, linking them together, continuing to communicate with each other, and quite frankly, building ties, intergenerational, cross-generational ties with other people, because they're eager to learn, they're eager to understand more about the world that we live in, and eager to transform it.
Well, you know, a couple of things that come to mind. I mean, right now, certainly what many people refer to as up south, there are those in the liberal community that take great comfort in trying to suggest that this was fundamentally an expression of the most extreme forms of white supremacy organization, that this is down south, that this happened, that it is an attack on a faith-based organizations, not necessarily which just almost inadvertently took on a racial dimension. There are those who are, my goodness, wonderful. South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley is suggesting to take down the flag, and what they're going to do is at some time in the not-too-distant future, they'll have a debate around whether or not to take it down. As I indicated, eBay, Walmart are going to stop selling merchandise with the indicia of the Confederate flag and printed upon them. Really, to go deeper, how dare we really kind of rest content with that, and what really needs to be the kind of critique and ownership of liberal society as to what happened, which was its most extreme punctuation, these executions of a racist supremacy. But as you pointed out, there is the day-to-day manifestations of racism in housing, in health care, in job disparity, in mass incarceration, that we have not owned. The liberal community hasn't owned this.
In addition to that, you know, I don't know what flag was flying over the Ohio State House when 12-year-old Tamir Rice was playing with a toy in a park. Mm. And he was shot down by police officers within seconds of their arrival. I mean, this is even more amazing given that Ohio is an open carry state where even if he had had a real gun, it would have been polite for him to be, it would have been legal for him to be walking around with it publicly that way, even if it had been a real gun. So the whole idea of him being demanded to do whatever they claimed they insisted, and they said two or three times, which didn't have time to do in the second and a half, 2 seconds before they killed him. You know, there was no Confederate flag flying over that. You know, in Detroit, when they were cutting off the water to people's homes, you know, in those other cities in Michigan where administrators have taken over, where elected governments and, you know, once were, there's a Confederate flag flying over there. In these devastated cities all across the country where the export of capital has left them largely without jobs, with communities where unemployment rates are 40 to 60%, and the level of desperation that people face every day, a demeaning, alienating life that has led some people into trying to reconstruct an economy around escapism and drugs. There's several Confederate flag hanging on that. So the fact that Walmart is quit selling Chinese-made Confederate flags, I'm sure it must mean something to somebody. Doesn't mean all that much to me. And it certainly doesn't get to the core of the problem that we face.
You know, we've just about run out of time. I hope you come back and we can continue to explore these issues. Minimally, this must be a teachable moment, and you have a lot to instruct us in and to get to that core of the institution of programmatic demands relevant to that three-pillared, the militarism of the society, the racial deprivation and inequities, and the economic deprivation. I want to thank you very much for sharing some of your thoughts. Can we get you back?
Absolutely.
Well, we have...
Give me a call, let me know, and we'll set it up.
You got it. We've been speaking with Ed Whitfield all morning. We've been trying to really expound on and look at the inequities in our society. Been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash, and log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.